Welcome, and thank you for standing by. All participants will be in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer portion of today's call. If you would like to ask a question at that time, please press star then one. Today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, please disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn today's call over to your host, Chris McConkley. You may begin.
Thank you, Erin. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to today's webinar. My name is Chris McConkey, and I'm one of the organizers for today's call. Today's webcast is presented by the Illinois Department of Human Services, Division of Mental Health, and the Illinois Mental Health Collaborative. The title of today's webinar is DHS-DMH Training for New Rule 132 Providers. The presenters will be from the Division of Mental Health, Dr. Mary Smith, Associate Director of Decision Support, Research, and Evaluation, Leanne Reinert, ASO Clinical Policy Specialist, Griggs Jones, Provider Access Specialist. And from the collaborative, we have myself, Chris McConkey, I'm a clinical coordinator, and Trish Gorda, Business Systems Analyst 2, Callie Lacey, Clinical Services Supervisor, and Sue Kappas, Clinical Quality Assurance Advisor. Today's training will cover the following topics: billing requirements and registration, the authorization process, service matrix, consumer eligibility, reimbursement submission of claims to HFS, resolving claims issues, and provider enrollment provider databases. We're going to take a short break at about the halfway point. Before we begin the formal presentation, I would like to review with everyone a few housekeeping items. If you happen to get disconnected from the audio portion, please call back into the same number you just dialed, which is 1-800-779-1506, and the passcode is Illinois. I apologize to everyone for having the wrong number out there. That was a mistake on my part. The visual portion of this presentation is web-based. Of course, you can choose the audio portion only, but if you would like to see the webinar PowerPoint presentation, the login information is located on the invite you received after you registered. If you're experiencing any problems with that particular link to join, you can also go to www.joinwebinar.com and enter the webinar ID directly, which is 452-132-746. There will be a designated question and answer portion at the end of today's presentation. The operator will open up the lines for questions at that time. Lastly, at the conclusion of the presentation today, we ask that you please complete the brief satisfaction survey that will appear when you close out of the online forum. It should take less than 5 minutes to complete the survey, and we value your feedback. I will now turn the call over to Dr. Mary Smith from the Division of Mental Health.
Thanks, Chris. Hi, good afternoon, everyone. Thanks again for joining us for the second day of training. So, as Chris said, the first piece of the training today will focus on Provider Connect and registrations. And I just wanted to give you a little bit of context for the information that you're about to see. So, the registration information is really critical to DMH. As we start to walk through the forms, you'll see that we're collecting some demographic information on individuals that you will serve and submit claims for to DMH for payment. We are collecting some clinical information as well, and then some additional descriptive information. This information is important to us because we use it for planning, we use it for budgeting, and we use it for federal reporting. It's really critical that we know and have information about the individuals for whom DMH, as the state mental health authority, purchases services. Again, as we start to walk through the application and the demonstration and the PowerPoints that follow, you'll notice that there are some clinical assessments that are required. Some you may be familiar with, like AXIS 5, the Global Assessment of Functioning Scale, or the Children's Global Assessment Scale. However, there may be some that you're not familiar with, such as the LOCUS. It's really critical, and I'm sure, you know, perhaps Leanne will talk about that a little bit later, but there will be training that is offered to you. It's really critical that you have an understanding of those scales, how to do the assessments before you start to submit registration information. Because, again, we think that information is critical and we use the information, and so it's important to have some consistent, valid, and reliable data. One of the things that will be covered, you know, is that there is a specific time period that's required to submit registrations, and that time period is 90 days. Now, as we, again, start to walk through the forms, you know, you may think to yourself, well, we can't collect all of this information in one sitting. This is one of the reasons that we've designed the process to permit you time to capture additional data from individuals. If you can collect all of the registration information that's required and complete the assessments, we always recommend that you submit that information as soon as possible. If, however, you can't get it at the first session or the second session, it takes a few additional sessions to collect that information, then we want you to collect that information and update the registration and then submit it within the 90-day time period. It's also possible to submit a registration and then go ahead and update it. But again, it's critical that we have all of the information or as much of the information that you can collect as possible. One of the other pieces that's related to the registration is that the registration really establishes an individual's eligibility for services purchased by DMH. I'm aware that you folks will be submitting claims for Rule 132 services, but it's really important and critical to remember that unless you submit a valid registration, you cannot bill for any of those services. As I mentioned yesterday, DMH has a working relationship with HFS. We provide HFS with business rules around that permits them to process the claims according to those rules. And so, again, it's really critical that you attend to the registration and get it right so that we get the information that we need and so that you can also receive prompt payment for claims submitted, or at least as prompt as it can be. So that's it. I'm sure, you know, if you have questions at the point that we take questions, I'll be happy to answer any of those. Chris?
Thank you, Mary.
Thank you.
Okay. Can everybody see my screen, Mary?
I can see it fine.
Okay. I'm going to provide you with an overview of Provider Connect and information on how to register, re-register, and close a consumer case in the system. Provider Connect is a free online secure application. It is a portal into the Collaborative's MIS system, and it can be accessed via the Collaborative website. Today, we will review how to access Provider Connect, how to register, re-register, and close a consumer's case, and what resources are available. Several tools are available within Provider Connect. These include the ability to register a consumer, view consumer registration status, close a registration, view authorization, view and print authorization letters, access and print forms, and submit inquiries to customer service. Several benefits may be realized by utilizing Provider Connect. Routine information can be easily accessed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Provider Connect is accessed through the Collaborative website at www.IllinoisMentalHealthCollaborative.com. It allows for multiple transactions to be completed in one session. Information may be viewed and printed, and calls for routine information are reduced. In order to access Provider Connect, you must be enrolled with the Collaborative and HFS. You must have a provider ID number assigned by Value Options. To get the provider ID number, you would contact National Networks at 1-800-397-1630 to obtain the provider ID number. Each provider is allowed one Provider Connect logon ID. If you need more than one Provider Connect logon ID, you will need to contact the Value Options EDI Help Desk, and their number is 888-247-9311, and then you would press option 3. The Help Desk is available from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. Central Standard Time. There is a 48-hour turnaround time when requesting additional logon. You must first register as a user for Provider Connect in order to access it. In order to register, you would go to the Collaborative website and click on the tab for Providers. This brings up the Provider Online Services page. You would click Register, and you will be taken to the Provider Online Services registration page. Note that all the fields with red asterisks are required fields, and you must complete all the required fields. When setting up your password, it is important to remember that the password has to be between 8 and 20 characters in length. It must contain one number, 0 to 9. It must contain one uppercase letter, A to Z. It must contain one of the special characters shown here. It can't contain any spaces, and the password is case sensitive. And passwords expire every 90 days. This is an example of what the Provider Online Services page looks like. You can see the Register tab here and the Login tab. So once you register, then you would just have to log in here in order to access Provider Connect. Registering consumers is important as the information submitted during registration is used for enrollment of individuals for DMH purchase services to determine the eligibility group for which the consumer is qualified, and that in turn determines what services DHS DMH is going to reimburse for. Before you can register a consumer, you must first obtain a consumer RIN, which is a recipient identification number, and DHS SS, the Social Services, which is also referred to as STBO, from HFS. This is done through the eRIN system, which can be accessed from the DHS website. Registration information will be updated within 5 business days, and how this works is that VO processes registration and assigns funds. They send fund information to HFS within one business day, and HFS processes the file, either accepting or rejecting it, and sends the results to Value Options by the second business day. There are several times you will need to access the registration screen. When registering a new consumer and closing from services at the same time, such as if someone came to you in crisis and then did not return, when registering a consumer who had been previously closed, when re-registering a consumer, which is required every 6 months in order to maintain eligibility for submission of claims, and then also when closing a registration of a consumer. When we begin the live demo, I will show you 2 paths for accessing registration screens. One is through specific consumer search, and the other is register a consumer. The Collaborative highly recommends that you use the path specific consumer search to verify the consumer is on file with the Collaborative. The direct path from register consumer, which you would think would be the one you would need to use, actually requires all consumer demographic information to be entered before the consumer is determined to be on file or not. Going through the consumer search will identify if the consumer is on file, and if so, the registration will pre-populate with demographic information that is on file. Before we move into the actual steps of how to register a consumer, I would like to point you to the Provider Connect Registration Guide, the June 2013 version, which is available on the collaborative website. Once you're on the collaborative website, you click on the tab for providers. Then there's links to the left, and you would click on provider information. And then the document can be found under the registration header. Or you can access it through the web, through this address listed here. The Provider Connect Guide provides an overview of the registration process and a detailed description of information required to complete the registration process. This screen shows the Provider Connect login screen. I also would like to let you know that right here under the new user register tab, there's also some assistance if you're having any technical problems with the site, and gives you phone numbers to call for any sort of assistance. So we're going to log in. Okay, I'm going to try it one more time. There we go. And that will pull up the Provider Connect user agreement. So once you read through this, you're going to click I agree if you would like to continue. And that pulls up this pop-up notice about the Federal Mental Health Parity Frequently Asked Questions link. And so you would just click OK. This is going to take you to your home page. And as you can see, it's individualized. So this will be each provider's personal home page. There's links over here to the left. And then there's also, you'll have a message center. At this time, for this person, this agency, there happens to be no messages. But there could be messages here for you. And then there's also other links in this section under what you want to do today. As I've mentioned, the collaborative highly recommends that you utilize specific member search or find a specific member to start the register process. As you can see, right below those two things are choices for register member or register a member. If you choose those, it won't pre-populate things, which is very helpful. So we really recommend that you do the find specific member search or find a specific member. We're going to click on that. And then you're going to have the consumer's RIN and date of birth are required fields. And for date of birth, as you see, it's month, day, and then the full year. Taking a little bit of time. Okay, there we go. And this takes you to looking at the top of the screen, you can see five tabs that are part of the registration process: demographics, enrollment history, POBs, benefits, and additional information. So this begins the demographics section. We're going to click on View Consumer Registration, which is right here. as you can see, if nothing comes up, you should scroll down just a little bit. These are the consumer registrations that are on file. It could be that if there's no, if it shows no existing registrations found for the agency, you're going to get, in this section right here, you're going to get a message that says no records found. And then you would click on add a consumer registration. Okay, so this brings up the beginning of the registration process. And please note that all items, all fields with an asterisk are required fields. And in this section, they're not really red to show you easily, but as you can see, registration start date has an asterisk right there. Some fields will pre-populate when registering, using the specific member search and add a consumer registration. As you can see with the RIN, last and first name, et cetera, there are several areas that pre-populated. If you had gone through register a consumer, it would not have done that. And so this is really helpful, and I can really stress that it's really highly advised to go through the specific consumer search. The registration start date is for the six-month registration period, cannot be backdated more than 90 days, and cannot be a future date. The client ID is a unique ID number assigned by the agency to the consumer. And as you can see, this is not a required field. And the agency's fee number did pre-populate, as did the Medicaid site ID. So down here, you also have the last and first name. It covers the date of birth, the mother's maiden name. Social Security is a required field and did not pre-populate, so you would want to make sure you put something in there. Primary address. Address line 2 is not a required field. Williams class consumer would be a yes or no. And then if it was a yes, then this IMD home code would be required, but as it's a no, it is not. Household income is a required field and does not pre-populate. Same as client income, household size. Household composition is a drop-down box. Qualifying exceptions is not a required field. It would indicate if the consumer has a qualifying exception that would allow registration without meeting income requirement. And if it's not applicable, you just leave it blank. Education level, military status, marital status, employment status, and then Social Security. Okay. SSI, Supplemental Security Income, and SSDI, Social Security Disability Insurance. we have different options that it had populated. DFI, CFI is related to donated funds initiative, contracted funds initiative, enrollment status. And court forensic is a required field. Now, there's five fields for race. The first field is he was registered as being white, and then he doesn't have any other races, and so there's nothing to report for the other fields. Citizenship over here is yes or no or unknown. Hispanic origin gives your options. Language, there's several languages that you can input. Whether there's interpreter services needed. And what the mental health residential arrangement is. Whether there's justice system involvement, which is a required field. And if the person is a disaster guest type. Disaster guest relates to what type of a disaster brought the consumer to Illinois. And the options are Illinois Hurricane Katrina or Hurricane Rita or NIU incident. And then if you do fill that in, then you required fields would be disaster guest state and county. Then you would notice the consumer has a third-party payer, mental health residential indicator. That relates to whether or not the consumer is enrolled in the DHS-funded mental health filler program. So that's a yes or no. Then down here, in this portion, the special program enrollment, you're going to be answering yes or no to whether they're involved in any of these special programs. Juvenile justice, PATH grant, Region 1 crisis care system, ICD community services, and CHP. So you'd be yes or no, and then underneath each one of those is the begin and end date. So if you click on yes on any of these, you would need to input the beginning date. But for our person, he does not receive any special enrollment. And then you're going to answer consumer in residential or Northwest Crisis Care Program funded by DMH. We're going to say no. Do they receive permanent supported housing? No. Money follows the person? No. And then down here you see this mental health closing section. This portion is gathered when you're actually closing a registration. So we're going to click next. This takes you to the select funds page, and this system, as you saw, as you can see, has automatically defaulted to the eligible funding sources. As I believe everyone on the call is going to be providing just Rule 132 services, they may not actually receive all of these funding types, but for our example, this is what was pulled up. So we're going to click next. Then this takes us to a similar screen, but it also includes the effective and expiration dates, and then there'll be messages. It is important to note that when you've reached this page and if everything looks fine to you, don't assume that you're going to be assigned all the funds listed when viewing this screen, because you still have to continue the registration process. And at the very end of the process, you're going to be told if the registration has been approved and exactly what funds have been assigned to the consumer. We're going to scroll down here and click continue. This takes us to the diagnosis page. So all three fields for Access 1 are required. So the highlighted areas you can click on and it will give you options. So for our example today, going to put in, we're going to click on the little link here, and it'll put it into the system and put also include the description. Then because these fields are also required, you can't leave those blank. So we're going to do the same thing for each of those. Then over here is Access 2 to the right, and it's the same way. You can click on the link, and it gives you your choices. And each one of these is under Access 2 is a required field. So we're going to, for our test person, we don't have, they have just the one diagnosis. Then you're going to complete the information for Access 3. The diagnosis code 1 is a required field, but not 2 and 3. So for our test person, they don't have any medical issues. Principal diagnosis indicator tells you which of these is their principal diagnosis, which would be Access 1, Diagnosis 1. Then you go to the first presentation assessment. And you need to answer yes or no to these questions. And you have to read these questions carefully. The first one is the primary diagnosis is reported in the registration was obtained by a psychiatrist. So that would be yes for our person. The consumer does not have a history of autism, pervasive development disorder, mental retardation, or organic brain disease or trauma. And so they don't have that. And so that would be a yes. The consumer has not had more than 16 weeks of antipsychotic medication treatment, and in this case, he has not, so that would be a yes. And then you're going to click Next. And this will show you that if you leave something off inadvertently, it's going to pop up an error message for you that you have to complete that information before you can go on. And as you can see here, I forgot to include, this was a required field, you can see by the asterisk, and I forgot to include which type of diagnosis code I was using. And in this case, it's the DSM because our person, is, anyway, in this case, it's the DSM. So we're going to, everything else got left, so I don't have to re-enter anything. I'm just going to go down here to Next again. And that takes me to the next screen, which are the functional scales. And our test person is 21. And so it pre-populated that what you're going to have to fill out is the GAS information instead of the CGAS. There's two choices. And so it pre-populated GAS. So we're going to leave all this CGAS information alone and move down to the GAS information. We're going to put his score there. Then you're going to assess all these fields here, social group, school, whether they're serious impairment or not, employment, financial, community living, supportive social, daily living activity, inappropriate or dangerous behavior, previous functional impairment. And this takes us into the LOCUS results, and you're going to input information about the categories of LOCUS, and so risk of harm, functional status, comorbidity, recovery, environment stressors, recovery environment support, recovery and treatment history, and acceptance and engagement. And then as you can see, it added up the composite score on its own down here, and then it tells you what the LOCUS recommended level of care is for this person. And then the assessor recommended level of care. Now this says a medically monitored residential service. So for the purpose of this demonstration, because all of you are community providers, I'm going to change these real quickly. And so down here, do you see where it would say low intensity community-based services? As I was changing the numbers, it lowered the score here, and then it changed here. And then you're also going to assess what you feel as an assessor is the recommended level of care. And in this case, for my example, it's going to be a community-based service. Then these areas do not apply to an adult, so we're going to click next. And that takes us to the history of illness section. And so all of these are consumer does not meet treatment history or consumer does. Consumer does meet or doesn't meet. You're going to fill out if there's co-occurring disorder, evidence-based practice, integrated dual disorder treatment, evidence-based practice supported employment, evidence-based practice medication algorithm. Click next. This is the mental health cross disability section. Doesn't apply to this person, so we're going to click next. As you can see, I'm getting error messages. Form completion date is required, primary caregiver age is required, and type of service needed is required. So we're going to say mental health case management. And this is really helpful when you get the error messages, actually, because it points out right away what are the required fields. So this is type of service needed and type of service sought. Then we're going to hit next. Our test subject does not have a guardian. These are all the guardian fields that you would fill in. And then you hit next and it's loading all the information. Okay, this is the screen that shows you if your registration has been approved or not. And as you can see, it says status approved. You have successfully registered for the funding sources listed on the screen. Now, every funding source will be different for different consumers and different provider agencies. For the people, I believe, on this call, the only funding sources listed will be for Medicaid. And then it says the tab is to return. And up here you can view funding source enrollment details and click on that. And this gives you the enrollment details, what the person's registered for, effective date, expiration date. And so that is a very helpful screen. just a minute. So as you can see, these are also all these different field examples are also in the PowerPoint that will be available after the training today. We're going to post these in the next few days to the collaborative website. And the audio, MP3, and also the PowerPoint slides will be available to everyone. So for consumer re-registration, you would re-register a consumer and update key fields every 6 months to extend coverage. You would re-register a consumer, update key fields, and close at the same time. And an example would be if the previous registration on file for the consumer was past the six-month timeline, and then at the time of re-registering, the consumer was no longer receiving services. And then also to re-register a consumer, update key fields, and end date a special program. And that would be used when a special program is being closed and the consumer needed to be re-registered for other funds. So we started out by going to the home page, and as you can see, that's one of the options up here when I was in the other screen, and it will take you back to your individualized home page. So you're going to re-register a consumer, you're going to do the specific consumer search again. So we're going to enter in the consumer information again. Click on search. We're going to click View Consumer Registrations again. Scroll down. And it'll have these options here, whether to re-register, close registration, or do an address change. And we're going to re-register for, do you see it's ABC Funds? So you would click on re-register. You can re-register for any of the funds that were listed there. And this takes you back to the consumer registration information again. And as you can see, a lot of the information is pre-populated, race, interpreter, the county, and address. So a lot of this information will pre-populate when you do that. And you would fill all of that out and click Next. And it'll take you through all the steps that we had just gone through. So that is how you re-register a consumer. So to close a consumer registration, you're going to use the Close the Consumer Registration screens in order to close the consumer's registration, to end-date a special program, or to end-date a special program and close the registration both. It is important that the consumer status be updated when he or she is no longer enrolled in special programs or when the consumer is no longer being seen for services. So we're going to As you see, we're back on the home page. You're going to do the specific consumer search again. It's just the same for all three that we're doing. We're going to do the test person again. To register, re-register, to close a consumer are very similar in a lot of ways. We're going to go down again to view consumer registration. Scroll down. And you see the options for closing registration for the different funds that the person has. So if you click on close registration, that takes you back to the fields that you have to fill out to end date. So if they had, our person did not have any special program enrollments, you see that all of these are no. So there's no beginning or end dates to have to do. But you go down here to the mental health closing screen, and you're going to fill out all this information here, the date. The closing disposition is a drop-down box for you to choose from. The functional scale used at closing, which was GAPC, is pre-populates, which is nice. And then you're going to enter the gap that they had when you closed the registration. And then all the following information needs to be put in again. And then you would hit submit. And the consumer close, you will get a consumer close registration confirmation page, just like you got the approved page, and it will indicate that the registration status is closed. And so that's, I'm not going to take the time to go through this all again, but that's what would occur if you filled all the information in and were successful in closing the person. So we also have a customer support telephone number guide, which is very handy. And this guide is posted on the collaborative website. There's a little box in the upper left corner called In the Spotlight. And you can click on the link there to access this document. It tells you helpful phone numbers for different issues that you may be experiencing. And as you can see, the EDI help desk is one of the numbers listed several times. But this is a very helpful document. There's also a couple of situations that I just wanted to address real quickly. One is that there could be times where you might end up having a consumer that has multiple RINs. And if this situation was to occur, you would call the collaborative at this phone number and select the provider menu, then press 1. And you'll have a collaborative eligibility specialist will work with DMH, and DMH will direct the collaborative to keep or merge each of the RIN numbers. And so also, we've had issues in the past where it could be that maybe the person got married or something and their name changed, or maybe there's a date of birth that needs to be changed in the system. And we just wanted to point out that the consumer's name and date of birth that the collaborative has on file is the consumer's name and date of birth that the collaborative received from HFS. So if you need to correct anything like that, you need to correct it through HFS. And then once that correction has been made with HFS, HFS will notify the collaborative through the eligibility file we get from Daily. So I'm going to turn the call over to Trish Gorda, Business Systems Analyst 2 with the Collaborative, who's going to go over how to complete a batch registration.
Good afternoon. As Chris said, my name is Trish Gorda, and I'm going to be walking you through some screens to show you the batch registration process within Provider Connect. To have a complete understanding of everything that you'll need to know to successfully submit batch registration files, you will need to refer to the Batch Registration Submission Guide, and this guide is available on the Collaborative website, and I'll show you where to find that here in just a moment. This guide is going to provide you a wealth of useful information regarding your batch file, everything from obtaining a submitter ID and password, file specifications needed for your file. Also, the necessary batch file layout will be reviewed, and also there's information on error processing. So in the last demo, Chris showed you how to register an individual consumer using the online registration screens in Provider Connect. In this portion of the training, I'll be showing you how to submit multiple registration records on a specially formatted batch file using the batch registration submission process, which, as I said, is also accessible in Provider Connect. Now, regarding the batch registration submission guide, I have a screenshot here of the provider information page on the Collaborative, and I've also got the website here. You're going to find the batch registration submission guide under provider information and then under the registration section right here. So now let me go ahead and start walking you through some of the screens, or all of the screens, I should say, that you'll need to submit your batch files. How you're going to do that, you're going to start off at your provider homepage, and you're going to select the EDI homepage option on the left-hand menu. And I think that this it might be an old screenshot. I think that actually the EDI homepage options might be further down on the left-hand menu. So this is a screenshot of the EDI homepage. And just to review the different parts of this page, from this screen you can submit a new batch file, you can see the batch files that you've previously submitted, and then you can retrieve your response files from here as well. So in order to get the submission ball rolling, you're going to click the Submit Batch File button. And step one of the process is to select the form type. And your form type is always going to be batch reg. Once you select that, you can press the next button. And step two of the process would be to enter information that is regarding to validate the actual file. However, for this particular form type, you don't have any questions to answer, so we're just going to click Next on this screen as well. So step three of the process is where you're actually going to select your file, and you can just select the Browse button and then select it from here, and then you're going to hit the Submit button. Finally, step four, you get a message saying that the file was successfully sent. So but your batch file may have been sent successfully, but you also need to make sure that it was received successfully. Just because you received this screen that says that your file was successfully submitted does not mean that it was successfully accepted. In order to see that, you'll need to download the response file, the summary file, in order to tell if the file was accepted or rejected. So if your batch file was rejected, there's a few different reasons why your batch file could be rejected. The batch file may not have been formatted correctly, or there could be an issue with the trailer record. With all of these rejections, the only way you're going to know why your batch file rejected is to retrieve your summary response file so that you can see the errors. And I just want to reiterate, even though you see that screen that says your batch file was submitted successfully, it does not mean that the file was accepted successfully. So you really need to pay attention to those response files when they come back, especially the summary file. That's going to give you the success or failure of your submission. Now, just to give you a little bit of a review of the different types of response files that you can get. First of all, as I've just described, you're always going to get a summary file. This file is going to indicate if the registration file was accepted or was rejected. And just a note, if your batch file was completely rejected, then this is the only response file that you're going to get. If your batch file was accepted, you could also receive an accepted file. This file is going to contain all of the registration records that were accepted. If all of the records on your file were accepted, then the only two files that you're going to get are the summary file and the accepted file. You may also get an error file, and this file is going to contain all of the registration records that were rejected. If none of the registration records on your file were accepted, in other words, they were all rejected, you're going to have a summary file and an error file. However, you may have some records on your file that were accepted and some that were rejected, kind of a mix. In that case, you're going to have three separate files: your summary file, your accepted file that shows all the registration records that were accepted, and an error file that shows you all of the registration records that were rejected. So now I'm going to show you how to retrieve the file. And to do that, we will go back to the EDI homepage via the provider home screen. And down in this bottom section, in the incoming files section, this is where you're going to see your response file. Now, one thing that I didn't mention before is when you submit your batch registration file, you're going to get an email that contains a submission number. So how you'll match up these incoming files, these response files, with your particular batch: the file name on the incoming file is going to correspond with your submission number that you received in your email. So if you have three files here that all contain the same submission number, you can assume that you've got a summary file, an accepted file, and an error file. The first one, however, that you're going to want to look at is the summary file. And the summary file is going, it's kind of hard to read these incoming files, but each of the files end in a particular letter that denote what type of file it is. The summary file ends in an R. So that is the first file that you're going to want to click on to retrieve. Okay, so once we click on that file that ends in the R, that's going to take us to the View Incoming File screen. And then go ahead and you will click on that file name again, the one that ends in R. And then you'll get your screen that's asking you if your file was downloaded successfully. If it was, click yes and you'll return to the EDI homepage. However, if it was not downloaded successfully, you can click no and try to download the file again. You'll get this screen if you clicked no, that your file was not downloaded successfully. You can try it again through the method that we just retrieved the files on. Or there is another way to retrieve the file. If you just right-click on the file and select Save As, you can also save the file that way. And then lastly, if you are having trouble submitting a registration file or if you're having trouble retrieving any of your files, you can call the EDI Help Desk at the number shown here. So that is the end of my batch registration presentation. At this time, I will turn the training over to Leanne Reiner, ASO Clinical Policy Specialist of the Division of Mental Health. And Leanne will be speaking about the authorization process.
Thanks, Trish. Good afternoon, everyone. Many of you probably heard my voice for maybe too long yesterday afternoon. I am the Clinical Policy Specialist here in Community Services, and again, my office is in Springfield. I'm going to be talking to you on a couple of different subjects today. The first one that I'm going to talk to you about is utilization management. And I'm getting my controls here, so. Chris, can you see my screen now?
Yes, ma'am.
All right, thanks. Okay, so I'm going to be talking to you, as I said, about our utilization management programs here within the Division of Mental Health. We use utilization management for a few things. We want to make sure that the services that are being provided to the individuals receiving them are best suited to support what they need in order to recover as well as what their preferences are. We want to make sure that we are reimbursing services that are cost effective and provided in the most appropriate setting for the individual. And we need to make sure that the services that are provided are consistent with our medical necessity criteria, as well as the evidence-based practices that we try to promote as the State Mental Health Authority. So we implemented our UM program trying to achieve balance between the needs, preferences, and the well-being of the persons in the state that need mental health treatment, the medical necessity, and the availability of resources that we have to provide and reimburse for those services. At no time does our utilization management program limit medically necessary services reimbursed by Medicaid, and our UM program is fully compliant with both the Illinois Medicaid state plan as well as associated federal rules for Medicaid services. There are three components to our UN program. First is our medical necessity guidance and criteria. I believe that manual was mentioned in some of yesterday's presentations. It is posted on our DMH provider website for your review. We have limited external authorization, which means we have some services selected that require some authorization, and I'm going to go through each of those in more detail in just a little bit. And then we also do some analysis related to the data that our providers report to us about the utilization of specific services. So our medical necessity guidance and criteria, again, we have the manual posted to our website. It includes medical necessity criteria for assertive community treatment, community support team, psychosocial rehabilitation, community support, and therapy counseling. If a service is available both to adults and children, there are separate medical necessity criteria that have been developed for each of those populations. Okay, you can find the criteria in our manual. You need to use that criteria to make consistent decisions as you admit people into services at your agency, as you determine whether there's a continuing need for services, as well as when you are making decisions about whether or not it's time to terminate services for the individual. You need to use these criteria that have been published regardless of whether or not we are doing external authorization on the service. This is because we also evaluate whether or not there is adherence to that criteria during times when we do post-payment reviews. For the limited external authorization, the second prong of our utilization management program, we require authorization before we will pay for specific services. And we chose those services based on a review of service utilization patterns for a previous fiscal year before choosing the service. We looked at data from a previous fiscal year. For services that have thresholds, the thresholds are the same for adults and children and adolescents. Those thresholds are calculated by provider and consumer per fiscal year. So if you have a consumer that may have gone to a different provider within the same fiscal year, services they received from that provider are not considered when we are calculating a threshold for services prior to your need to seek authorization. The authorization for payment for services beyond those thresholds that we've established was based on medical necessity criteria, and we will continue to authorize services as long as you are able to demonstrate that there is medical necessity for those services. So this table just shows you the different services that we require authorization for and the types of authorization that are required. So you'll see for our team services, ACT and CST, you have to get authorization at the time of admission into the service, and then you have to seek continuing authorization as well. For our other services, which I will sometimes refer to in this presentation as our threshold services, you don't have to get authorization through the process before you admit someone into that service and before you start providing that service. However, you do have to track how many units of that service you are providing to the individual, and if they are meeting the threshold where the where authorization is going to be required, then at that point you need to seek authorization. So you'll see for psychosocial rehabilitation, PSR, and community support group, you don't have to seek authorization for the first 800 units, which is 200 hours, of those two services in sum. So maybe you've provided 100 hours of PSR and 100 of CSG, or 50 of PSR and 150 of CSG. It's the combined total that gets you to the point where you need the authorization. And then for therapy counseling, it's 40 units, which is 10 hours. And finally, our third prong of the UM program, ongoing data reporting and analysis. We look at utilization patterns for services. We look at post-payment review results. We study the impact of authorization and consider other both quantitative and qualitative aspects of service delivery in our analysis of utilization of services across the system. We use that information to plan for provider technical assistance, to plan for any further training that appears to be needed, and also to inform us if we need to modify, for instance, if we needed to modify the threshold at which we sought authorization. Okay, the first thing to consider for our utilization management, again, medical necessity criteria, that manual, each service has five sections defined. The first is the diagnostic section. Then there's service initiation criteria, meaning what has to be there before you start the service for the person. Continuing service criteria, that's the criteria for if the person has been in the service for a while and you're making a determination of whether or not they need to continue the service. Exclusion criteria is criteria that would say this is not an appropriate service for them and they should not be receiving the service. And then service termination criteria, the criteria for when you're going to decide to close someone out. Diagnosis, first of all, there has to be a current eligible mental health diagnosis, and the proposed course of treatment should be considered effective for that diagnosis. The symptoms that the individual is reporting and that you are documenting should be consistent with that diagnosis according to the DSM. Excuse me. And as I mentioned yesterday, we are still at this point in time using the DSM-4 within the Division of Mental Health. You saw that as Chris was going through the registration slides today, and that is the manual that you would be referencing for the medical necessity criteria at this point as well. And finally, the symptoms for which you are proposing the treatment should not have their primary origin in a diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder, a substance-related disorder, or a principal diagnosis of mental retardation or intellectual disability. This does not mean that the person cannot have a co-occurring disorder diagnosis of any of these types of things. It's just that the funds from the Division of Mental Health are appropriated for the treatment of mental health diagnoses that are that do not include these particular disorders. Those disorders are funded through the state in different ways, and so if the course of treatment you're recommending, if the purpose of that is amelioration of symptoms of autism, substance-related disorder, mental retardation, intellectual disability, then you need to seek funding for those services from the appropriate part of the state, and that's not the Division of Mental Health. Okay, the service initiation criteria. The service initiation criteria is to be considered by providers for all individuals receiving services for which guidance is published. So regardless of whether you're going to get to the 10 hours of therapy counseling for an individual, before starting therapy counseling, you need to consider the medical necessity criteria for therapy counseling, again, because we can look at that at the time of a post-payment review. And this, again, establishes the basis for the need for the service from the beginning. Then continuing service criteria, once an individual meets a threshold for a service, then you need to look at the continuing service criteria because that is what the collaborative's authorization decision is going to be based on. Again, exclusion criteria, reasons the service would not be appropriate for the individual. And if you are providing that service, it's possible in the post-payment review that if there was evidence that it was not appropriate and that exclusion criteria were met, then that could be something that could be brought up at the time of a post-payment review. And termination criteria, again, reasons for discontinuing service. It at the time that you might have a clinical practice guidance review or an authorization review, these could be cited as reasons why you should terminate the service as well. Just a word about the slides that are coming up now. Some of the content I've taken verbatim from the manual. Other time I've paraphrased it so that we can condense our presentation a bit. You're strongly encouraged to read through the Medical Necessity Criterion Guidance Manual in its entirety so that you're sure that you fully understand the DHS-DMH requirements. Okay, we're going to start with therapy counseling. Service initiation criteria for therapy counseling. You're looking at, first of all, the severity and complexity of symptoms and level of functional impairment require therapy counseling as evidenced by, and then you'll see what it is we're looking for, that the individual has an emotional disturbance or diagnosis that's destabilizing or distressing. That the individual's assessment, the mental health assessment that we talked about during the Rule 132 part yesterday, identifies specific mental health problems that may be effectively addressed by therapy counseling. And then finally, we're looking for a LOCUS score equating to a level of care recommendation of 2 or higher for adults. In children, we're looking at the clinician-rated Ohio scale of 16 or higher for youth age 5 and up. If you have been providing therapy counseling and you're getting to the point where you're going to reach the threshold and you're considering whether or not to seek authorization to continue, you need to look at the continuing service criteria. The first thing that we need to know is that the individual has been actively participating in the therapy counseling service. You need to be able to show demonstrated evidence that the person is experiencing significant benefit from therapy counseling, that most of the treatment goals have been attained, but you've not yet reached the goal. The full functioning hasn't been restored, and that the individual is continuing to have destabilizing emotional distress that is continuing to interfere with daily functioning. And finally, that the individual can't be safely and effectively treated through solely through the use of community support, case management, or the engagement of natural support systems. Because therapy counseling has different modalities that you can provide it through, there are some additional criteria related to those. For individual, you need to show that there's a necessity for the individual to meet one-on-one with the therapist. For group, you need to show that there are specifically identified problems with social interactions, interpersonal difficulties, et cetera, for which involvement in a group process would be beneficial to the person. And finally, if you are proposing family therapy or providing family therapy, then you need to show that the identified problems of the individual are made worse by the dynamics within the family, or that's going to be the most effective way to address the issues is through involving the family. The exclusion criteria for therapy counseling, someone with a level of cognitive impairment, mental status, or developmental level that make it unlikely that the individual is going to actually benefit from the therapeutic intervention, or if the primary problem could be addressed more effectively by a different modality. For service termination, if you've reached the treatment goals, then therapy counseling should be discontinued. If you've reached the majority of goals and the remainder could be safely achieved by accessing other services or natural supports, or if the person hasn't made any improvement, then there needs to be a reassessment for a more effective treatment than therapy counseling. We would not expect someone to have made no progress at all and just continue on with therapy counseling. There are, you know, a variety of other mental health services within Rule 132, and we would expect that there would be some exploration of what service might be more appropriate if the person's not making any progress. Okay, for psychosocial rehabilitation, PSR, our service initiation criteria, we're looking for significantly impaired role functioning in at least two areas that include financial management, the ability for the individual to get the services that they need on their own, any impairment in socialization, communication, et cetera, related to living within the community, impairment in their activities of daily living, impairment in their ability to manage their own symptoms, as well as significant impairment of concentration, endurance, attention that is necessary for the person to attain the skills they need for recovery. And if you remember from the Rule 132 presentation yesterday, PSR is a facility-based, very intensive, skill-building intervention. So that's why we're looking for that significant impairment of role function where you need to really address specific skills. For someone to be in need of PSR services, their LOCUS score should recommend a level of care of 3 or higher. That's high-intensity community-based services. And we are looking at the time that you initiate services for a discharge or transition plan that's focused on increasing community integration through the application of the skills you're going to work on in PSR in community settings. So looking at a plan to transition that person out of the PSR classroom type setting into community support services where they can practice those skills in natural settings. For continuing service criteria, so individuals that have met the threshold and you believe they need to continue in PSR, we would be looking for modifications to the treatment plan that identifies the skills that the individual hasn't yet been able to successfully demonstrate, and that the individual cannot safely, effectively develop those skills through some type of alternative community-based services or engagement of natural supports. So they still are in need of that intensive, more classroom group setting than just moving on to community support at that point. Exclusion criteria, PSR is not available to anyone under the age of 18, so that's one. If the individual doesn't want to participate in PSR, that's another one. Again, if the primary reason that the person is experiencing problems with role function is related to their to an intellectual disability or an organic process or syndrome that that includes normal aging, then that's not a reason to provide PSR. If the individual already has sufficient ADLs and skills to make progress in their recovery, then PSR is not the place for them to be. And also, if someone requires more intensive contact than PSR, then they should not be going to the PSR program. If what they need is a more intense service. Service termination criteria, once the individual has learned the skills and asks for termination or no longer needs that active level of treatment, if the individual's learned most of the skills, can apply and improve the skills within the natural setting, then again, that's a time to transition them to community support. Or, again, if the person's not making any progress at all, then there needs to be a reassessment to determine what service would be more appropriate for their needs. Okay, our next one, community support group. This is the service that we combine for the threshold with PSR. It is similar to PSR as it is focused on skill development. However, this service is expected to be provided in more natural settings, and again, in group settings with other individuals that are capable of working on their skills in these natural settings. So what we're looking for, again, is impairment in functioning that includes an inability to apply the skills the person has in natural settings, or an inability to build or utilize the supports that are available to them in their community settings. Individuals that need community support are those that would require small group support to facilitate more effective role performance. There needs to be identification of specific things that are impaired that can only be remediated through this small group practice that's going to reinforce that development of the skills. For an individual to need community support group, there needs to be a locus level of care recommendation of 2 or higher. Okay, now we're going to talk about the medical necessity criteria for our 2 team services. The first one, community support team. Again, as I said in the Rule 132 training yesterday, the rule specifically defines eligibility criteria for each of our team services. So, of course, the person must meet the eligibility criteria as defined in the rule. There is a Rule 132 eligible diagnosis with symptoms consistent with the diagnosis. For community support team, the individual must require team-based outreach and support. And be expected, if they get that team-based outreach and support, to be able to access and benefit from the traditional array of mental health services. And the individual has to have tried and failed to benefit from less intensive services or have been considered for those services by the agency and found inappropriate for less intensive services, perhaps through consideration of the medical necessity criteria. And then there is a whole list of choices. The individual has to exhibit at least 3 of them. It includes things like hospitalization and crisis contacts, detox services, risk of losing placement in a home, evidence of self-harm, that type of thing. You can certainly read through all of those criteria on your own. Then we need to see evidence of severity and or complexity of symptoms and level of functional impairment that require coordinated services provided by a team of mental health professionals and support specialists. And when we talk about a team of mental health professionals, as we talked yesterday, we expect the team to be multidisciplinary and for the team members to have special skill sets and special talents that they bring to the job. And so the idea is that the individual needs a variety of services. This is not a concept of a team where you just have a couple of people that are available in case somebody goes on vacation, somebody else knows the person. That's not community support team. We're talking about actually the person needing the specialized services from a variety of individuals. So, again, the way that you would know that a person actually needs a team would be things like frequent hospitalizations, excessive use of crisis services, repeat incarceration, et cetera. For adults, we're looking for a level of care utilization system score, level of care recommendation, generally of a 4, or if it's less than 4, then you can fill out when you do the registration, you can justify why the person needs CST even though their level of care recommendation might be a 3. Okay, so there is that ability for adults. When we're looking at kids, we're looking for a minimum score of 16 for problem severity on the workers' form of the Ohio scales. Reasons that someone would be excluded from the community support team service: first, if the individual has sufficient skills to be able to make progress in their recovery with support of the more traditional mental health services that don't provide as intensive a level of contact as CST does, then they would not need CST. If an individual has a level of cognitive impairment, a current mental status or developmental level that is so severe that they're not going to likely benefit from CST, then they wouldn't be authorized for CST. And if the individual requires a more intensive team service, meaning ACT, because they need a more assertive outreach component, as ACT has, or if they need a more restrictive treatment setting, which would be like a 24-hour supervised setting, and can't be safely or effectively treated with CST, then CST would not be authorized for them either. Service termination criteria: either if an individual has achieved most of their treatment goals and requests termination again, or is assessed to no longer require the CST level of services, then they should be stepped down to a different type of treatment. If they've achieved some of their goals, it's determined that they can safely achieve the remainder of their goals with less intensive treatment, they should be stepped down. If they have a written plan that spells out how they're going to be transitioned to those services, or if the person is not demonstrating significant improvement with the CST service, then there needs to be reassessment to determine what would be the more appropriate service for the person. And finally, for assertive community treatment, this service has very specific eligibility criteria listed in the rule, and so those apply here as well. There is a limited list of diagnostic criteria or diagnoses that we will reimburse ACT for. It is, as you will see, primarily those psychotic disorders and then also bipolar disorder. This is because this is what ACT was developed for. It's what it's an evidence-based practice for, and so that's why the rule is written that way. Again, not only do they have to have been given that diagnosis, but there has to be evidence within your records that the symptoms that the person's experiencing are consistent with that diagnosis. And finally, as in the other services, the symptoms that are going to be addressed by ACT can't originate from autism, substance-related disorder, or principal axis to diagnosis of mental retardation. Again, we're still using DSM-4 terminology at this point. For service initiation, there needs to be an indication of agreement by the individual to receive the service. The individual has to be 18 or older because ACT is a service for an adult. The individual has to have a serious mental illness and require assertive outreach and support in order to be engaged in the mental health system. And the individual has to have a history of not benefiting from more traditional services. Again, we're looking at severity and complexity of symptoms. Again, we have a whole list of examples of that, including things like hospitalization, homelessness, crisis contacts, etc. And we're looking for functional impairments, either severe difficulty in daily living tasks, severe difficulty achieving employment that would sustain the person, or carrying out other roles of adults, such as a homemaker role or further education, or severe difficulty achieving a safe living situation. And for many folks that receive ACT, they may actually have impairment in all three of those areas. The locus level of care recommendation for ACT is a 4. In order to be authorized for ACT to meet medical necessity, the person has to have a current treatment plan that includes specific goals, objectives, and a discharge or transition plan. That means that ACT is not thought to be a forever service. There should be consideration to the individual making progress in recovery and eventually needing a lower level of care. And so there always has to be something in the plan, even if it's not going to happen immediately. There needs to be consideration for that as the person's treatment is being planned. The individual, again, can only be expected to make progress towards their recovery if they're receiving services from a highly coordinated team. We're talking about a team that has a psychiatrist, a nurse, clinicians, someone with lived experience in recovery, vocational specialists, as we talked about yesterday in the Rule 132 training, and that this individual has symptoms of an illness that are severe enough that they require frequent consultation between these various specialists, staffings, et cetera, so that they can get the care that they need. And finally, that there's no equally effective or less intensive service that could meet their needs. To continue in ACT, the person's severity of illness and the impairment that they are experiencing have to be demonstrated to continue to need ACT services. If the individual has been benefiting from the service and has made some progress but continues to need the level of care of ACT because they haven't yet had full restoration of their level of functioning, or it's expected that without the intensity of ACT, the individual wouldn't be able to maintain the progress that's been made, that they're functioning considerably well because they're receiving ACT, but at this point in time, it's obvious that the reason they're functioning well is because of the support of the ACT team, and if that support were withdrawn, then you would likely see a regression in symptoms. Then that is also a reason to continue the service. We're looking to make sure that the services being provided are consistent with the individual's goals, that the intensity and frequency of the treatment is appropriate and necessary for the individual, that the individual is being seen by multiple members of the team. Again, that is evidence that they actually need the interdisciplinary team service and not just a lot of an individual type of service. And we would, of course, also always be looking for evidence that active treatment is occurring and that it's expected that the person is going to continue to make progress. Reasons why ACT would not be the appropriate service for an individual would be if the individual already has sufficient skills that they could make the same progress through the use of community support, case management, the other mental health services that are a part of Rule 132 that are less intensive than ACT. If the individual is so cognitively impaired or has a current mental status or developmental level where they're not able to interact with the team and benefit from ACT,
or if the person requires a structured daily setting or supervised setting that cannot be provided through the ACT team within the community. Okay. Discharge from ACT. If the individual has achieved their goals and requests termination of services or is assessed to no longer need the active mental health treatment, then ACT should be discontinued. If they've achieved some of their goals and there's a plan to transition them to a less intensive service that will be able to meet their needs. Again, if an individual is not demonstrating any significant improvement, then there needs to be a reassessment and determination of what would be the more appropriate treatment. And finally, if the person has moved out of the ACT team's geographic service area and the ACT team has not been able to locate them, despite repeated efforts, then the individual should be closed to the team. The reason for this is that we do keep track of capacity in ACT, and so if someone's no longer receiving the services of ACT, then they need to be closed, and we need to track that capacity. But one word of caution here, it is expected, because the first word in ACT is assertive, that the team is doing assertive outreach and engagement efforts and not closing someone simply because they won't come into the office for appointments or they're not always home when the ACT team goes for regularly scheduled appointments. The whole purpose of ACT is to provide that assertive outreach and engagement to individuals that have failed to benefit from the more traditional levels of mental health care. Okay, I'm going to just briefly give you an overview of the authorization processes, and then the collaborative staff that actually do the authorizations are going to go into a lot more detail with you about how you get the authorization. For ACT and CST, we require authorization from the initiation of team services. So if medical necessity is demonstrated when you do your assessment of the individual and you've actually completed the assessment and the treatment plan, prior to the point where you request the authorization, then ACT can be authorized for up to 1 year and CST can be authorized for up to 6 months. If you seek the authorization prior to the completion of all the documents, then the authorization will only be provided for 3 months and then you'll have to seek a reauthorization at that point in time. This is all DMH policy. This is how we've directed the collaborative to do their work. For team services only, the authorization can be backdated to the initiation of services. That there is a time limit to that. As Dr. Smith said earlier, there's a 90-day window for registering people, and you have to get the authorization done within that 90 days as well. Of course, it always behooves you to get your authorization done as quickly as possible, because if there's any reason why the collaborative would clinically deny the authorization, you would want to know that before you had provided a lot of service. But we do recognize that because we require authorization from the time of admission for our team services, that you have to have some time to get your assessments done and your treatment plans and maybe start to serve the individual before you can complete the authorization process. So that's the reason why we allow backdating for these authorizations. This is the only authorization process that is built this way within the collaborative system, again, from DMH specifications. So you cannot backdate the other authorizations that we're going to talk about. Therapy counseling, again, anyone that you assess to be in need of therapy counseling, you can provide up to 10 hours or 40 units of the service as long as your LPHA has deemed that it was medically necessary and not submit an authorization request. If it appears that the individual is going to need services beyond that 10-hour, 40-unit threshold, then you need to submit your authorization request and obtain that authorization before you exceed that 10-hour, 40-unit threshold, because if you provide services during that exceed that threshold prior to getting the authorization,
those services will not be reimbursed by DMH because the way that the authorization process is built, you have to have the authorization in place at the time that you provide the service in order to be reimbursed for it, and the collaborative is not able to backdate those authorizations. The collaborative will determine the number of additional hours or units to be reimbursed based on the demonstration of medical necessity in the information that you provide to them. For PSR and CSG, the threshold, again, is 200 hours or 800 units. Again, we combine PSR and CSG. So for those first 200 hours, 800 units, you can provide that without an authorization so long as your LPHA has deemed that that is medically necessary and you've got that documented in your records. If it's deemed that an individual is going to exceed that 200-hour threshold, then, again, you have to submit your request for authorization and obtain that authorization before you get to that 200-hour, 800-unit threshold because, again, you will not be reimbursed if there's a period of service in between meeting that threshold and when your authorization is in place. If you provide services that haven't been authorized, there's no way to reimburse you for those. And again, determination of additional hours that will be reimbursed is based on the medical necessity that you demonstrate in the documents that you provide to the collaborative. Okay. Again, they're going to go through this in a lot more detail, but the collaborative clinical care managers review the documents you submit for medical necessity. If they meet it, if you meet it, then they're going to enter an authorization. And again, in order to be reimbursed for the service, you have to have your authorization in place at the time that you provide the service. So you need to be submitting your authorization in advance if you know that the person is going to exceed their threshold. There is an audit process in place to ensure the integrity of authorization. We don't routinely require that you submit a lot of documentation along with your authorization request, but we do ask the collaborative to do some quality checking, and so they have a random sample that they pull, and at that point they will notify a provider that a particular authorization has been selected for this audit process, and you will have to submit additional documentation for those particular requests. Information that you would be including at that point would be things like a mental health assessment, a treatment plan, progress notes that your LPHA deems particularly relevant to showing the continued need for service. And finally, there is an appeals process. If the collaborative denies an authorization, you do have an opportunity to appeal. The appeals process is explained in detail and in the documentation you would receive if there was a denial, and will also be explained in more detail as the collaborative staff go on with their training in just a bit. Okay, at this point, I'm going to turn things back over.
Leanne, would you like us to take a break right now?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I'm going to turn it back over to you, and then you can give us further direction.
Okay, we're going to take a break for, Rich, would you like it to be for 10 minutes?
Yes, that would be fine.
Okay, so we'll be back about, do you want to say 2:45?
Okay.
Okay, so we'll be back at 2:45.
Thank you.
If you and Rich and Mary have returned.
I'm back, yes.
Yes, I'm back too.
Are you ready for us to begin the second portion?
Yes.
Okay. Welcome back, everyone. We will now hear from Stu Kappas, Clinical Quality Assurance Advisor, and Callie Lacey, Clinical Supervisor of the Collaborative, on the Utilization Management Program Request for Services process.
Good afternoon. I'm Callie Lacey, the Clinical Supervisor, and Sue Kappas, Clinical Quality Assurance Advisor. We'll be covering the Utilization Management Program Request for Services process. This portion will take you step by step through the process of submitting UM requests for services through the use of Provider Connect. My portion will cover the turnaround times for all services, submission method for ACT, CST, and samples of the authorization form. So we'll be covering the therapy counseling, the CSG, and the PSR. The process. DHS-DMH requires the collaborative to respond to requests for authorizations within ACT, CST, 1 business day of receipt of a complete initial authorization request, excluding holidays and weekends. 3 business days for a complete reauthorization request, excluding holidays and weekends. Therapy counseling, CSG and PSR, are 7 days of receipt of completed authorization request, excluding holidays and weekends. I will cover the submission method of requests for ACT and CST. A provider may submit an ACT-CST authorization request using any of the following methods. 1, submit online at the www.IllinoisMentalHealthCollaborative.com/providers.atm or submitting via secure fax to 866-928-7177. The requirements, initial authorization request to request an authorization for a consumer who is not currently receiving ACT. The treating provider will submit a complete request for authorization of ACT packet that includes the ACT authorization request form that includes locus information for adults, the CST authorization request form that includes locus information for adults 18 plus, and Ohio scale resulting for children ages 5 through 17. An initial treatment plan with the ACT-CST listed as a service. The consumer's initial crisis plan and mental health assessment. Once the initial ACT request is submitted, the document will be reviewed for adherence to the clinical criteria based on the service definition, Rule 132, and the authorization treatment guidelines. If the clinical criteria are met for services, the collaborative will enter an initial authorization for 90 days of services if only an MHA is submitted at the time of the initial request. If a treatment plan is submitted, the clinician may enter an authorization for 12 months. Once the initial CST request is submitted, the documents will be reviewed for adherence to the clinical criteria based on the service definition, Rule 132, and the authorization treatment guidelines. If the clinical criteria met for services, the collaborative will enter an initial authorization for 90 days of service if MHA or treatment plan have been submitted. Before the initial authorization expires, the ACT or CST team is to submit a reauthorization request if the consumer continues to need ACT-CST services. This request should be submitted within 14 calendar days of the initial authorization expiration date. To request a reauthorization for a consumer who is currently receiving ACT-CST, the treating provider will submit a complete request for authorization of ACT-CST packet that includes the ACT authorization request form that includes locus information for adults, the CST authorization request form that includes Ohio scale for 5 to 17, and updated ACT-CST treatment plan, the consumer's crisis plan. Once the request for reauthorization of ACT services is submitted, the documents will be reviewed for adherence to clinical criteria based on the service definition, Rule 132, and the authorization treatment guidelines. If the clinical criteria are met for services, the collaborative will enter an authorization for either a 9-month authorization or a 12-month authorization. Once the request for authorization of CST services is submitted, the documents will be reviewed for adherence to clinical criteria based on the service definition, Rule 132, and the authorization treatment guidelines. If the clinical criteria are met for services, the collaborative will enter an authorization for 180-day authorization. Before the reauthorization expires, the ACT-CST team is to submit a reauthorization request if the consumer continues to need ACT-CST services. This request should be submitted within 2 weeks prior to the current authorization expiration date. This is a sample of the request for authorization for ACT, and you'll see a quarter of a way down, service definition criteria, as Leanne referred to that. Make sure that you please check all that apply. The next is another example of a form of the request for authorization of CST, and please refer to the service definition criteria, medical necessity criteria, and filling out all the information that is required. Now we'll turn the training over to Sue Kappas, and she will be covering authorization requests.
Good afternoon, everybody. To enter your auth request in Provider Connect, you need to log in. Take you to the authorization request page, and you can enter the request from either link, the one on the left-hand side or the one more towards that middle of the page. It'll bring you to the disclaimer page, where you select next. That will bring you to the member search page, and you'll search the member by using the RIN and the date of birth was a required. The next page is the member demographics page, where you'll verify the information is correct. Select next. Select your agency address from the provider location page. And that will bring you to the request for services page. this is an example of ACT. All fields marked with an asterisk are required. You will enter the requested start date when you want the ACT service to begin. Type of service is going to be mental health. Level of care is assertive community treatment. Level of service is outpatient. Under the section that says attach a document, this is where we'll attach the clinical information that you're going to send us for review. So this would be the place where you would attach the MHA, the treatment plan, the crisis plan, the ACT request form. Select next. You'll complete the clinical staff contact information on this page. Name, phone number, fax number. The next page is the service definition criteria. You'll check all that apply. For ACT, it asks if there have been any inpatient episodes in the prior 12 months. CST screen is slightly different. It does not include that section. And the service definition criteria is also different for CST. The next page will pre-populate, the diagnosis page will pre-populate from your registration. And if there's anything that has changed with the registration or with the LOCUS score, you will have to go in and re-register the consumer. Must be filled out on all five axes at this point. And if there's no diagnosis code, as you can see, we've entered the V71.09, no diagnoses in the field. The current GAF score is pre-populated. You'll need to enter the highest GAF score in the past year. LOCUS will pre-populate from the registration. Composite score will pre-populate. Leanne spoke a little bit about this earlier. There's a reason for deviation narrative history box where you can enter the narrative entry there if that score is not level 4, if it is lower than level 4. We'd like for you to explain in that box the reason for that deviation. Next screen is psychotropic meds. So list as much information as you can about the medication, the dosage, the frequency. Are there any side effects if the person is usually adherent? Who the prescriber is. The next page is the determination status. It shows printing and download options at the bottom of the screen. The first button to the left, you can print the result page. That's this page that you're seeing right now. The second is print the entire auth request. Third is download the entire auth request. The last button on the right will return the Provider Connect homepage. At this point, I'm going to turn it back over to Callie, and she's going to discuss discontinuation of ACT-CST services.
Hello. Providers must notify the collaborative when a consumer is discontinuing ACT or CST services by completing a notification of discontinuance of ACT CST services form and faxing it to the collaborative at 866-928-7177. Discontinuance criteria are outlined in the Service Authorization Protocol Manual, and also Leanne referred to it also. Detailed information regarding discontinuance of ACT, CST services, and linkage to other services must be documented in the consumer's clinical record. Notice of discontinuation is a sample of the ACT form, and you'll see the discontinuance criteria is listed, and please check one. There is an addition, and the CST is also the same. What is additionally required is more information regarding your consumers that are deceased. Number one, please submit them as soon as possible. This is very important. There's a new process that we have to perform, putting them in a Quality Connect file. There are about six questions that you need to answer with the deceased. Number one, was the death at the agency or at the consumer's residence, or indicate wherever it was, such as hospital, hospice, on the street, etc. Number two, was the cause of death from a previous medical condition? If so, what was it? Number three, was the agency aware of any terminal illness? Number four, was the death caused by anything other than natural causes? If so, then what? And if this cause was other than natural, which is number five, then were the police involved and to what extent? Last but not least, date and time the death was reported to the agency. Who reported it, and the person taking the information. And again, we encourage you to please submit these as soon as possible. And now I'm going to turn it back into the hands of Sue for the therapy counseling, CSG, and PSR submission.
Okay. There are two ways that a provider may submit a therapy counseling, CSG, PSR off request. You can do that through the Illinois Mental Health Collaborative website. You can also fax supporting clinical documents not attached to the request. I'll go over that a little bit as we get into this. Requirements are that the collaborative staff verifies the information for completeness. Any documents that you send, we also look at any narrative entries that are actually entered into the system, the clinical information. The information in the request, we make sure if it's consistent with the information found in the supporting documents. If inconsistencies are found, the provider will be contacted by one of our clinicians here and asked about any inconsistencies they find. If additional clinical information is required, the clinician will contact the provider to obtain clinical via the telephone, and the clinical information will be documented in the review. The collaborative clinical care manager reviews submitted docs for the following three elements: the completeness, the adherence to Rule 132, and the adherence to the medical necessity criteria. If the above three elements are met, the clinician will enter the authorization. If medical necessity is established, the request is off, and a letter is sent to the provider. If medical necessity is not established, the clinician contacts the provider to seek clarification and offer education regarding the authorization criteria. The collaborative and the provider will hopefully reach a mutual agreement with respect to the next steps. Could be that we might ask you to send us some additional information for review or recommend an alternative service. If mutual agreement has not occurred and the provider believes that medical necessity is present, the CCM will forward information to a collaborative physician advisor, we call here a PA reviewer, and the PA review will either authorize or deny the authorization. And Callie's going to talk to you a little bit more about that later on down the line. So in order to submit your request for therapy counseling, PSR, or CSG, you do have to submit that through Provider Connect. You would log into Provider Connect, and this process is similar to what we just went through. You can enter it on the left or on the right. Select Next. Again, you'll need to search your member with the consumer ID, RIN, date of birth. Verify that everything is correct on the demographics page and select Next. Select your provider location. It brings you to the requested service page. Requested start date has an asterisk. You will need to select that. The level of service, again, is outpatient. Type of service is mental health. And there's a drop down there. You will pick the level of care that you're requesting service for. In this case, it's therapy counseling. This is the section where you would attach clinical information if you choose to send it to us at the time that you're requesting. So if you have PDF capability, you may attach your documents to the request at this time, or as I mentioned earlier, you can fax the supporting documents 2866-928-7177. Request for services page is continued. You would enter the staff contact information and phone number. Date that the service actually started. It's right above the clinician's name and phone number. Brings you to the next page, which is the diagnoses page. And again, if any information has changed in terms of the diagnoses, the provider does have to re-register the consumer. Otherwise, it will populate. Fill out all five axes. We need a GAF score there. It should repopulate Ohio if it is a child. The person is a child under the age of 18. We also require that the medication section is completed. If the person is not prescribed any medication, and you can simply write under description, just write the word none, N-O-N-E. You could also let us know if there are side effects, if the person is adherent, and if the prescriber is a psychiatrist or a general practitioner. Next section is the LOCUS score that will pre-populate from the registration. Level 2 or higher, and if, again, if there is a reason for deviation, if it's not at that level, to describe that in this section. We'll hold 200 characters. Next page shows the Ohio, and then there's also the Devereux for under children under the age of 3. The next section under required documents, your faxing information, check, select attached, your faxing the documentation, whichever way you're going to send it. The next page, which is the services that you're actually requesting. So under therapy counseling, you have individual, group, and family, the start date, the end date, and the number of units that you're requesting. You can request all three at the same time. However, the authorization is put in for just one whole number of units. Again, the asterisks are required. There is a question that says, is there a written plan to facilitate the consumer's transition to alternative services or to terminate service provision altogether? And for medical necessity, there should be a transition or discharge plan in place. And the consumer or their guardian should be involved. And if there are services or other resources that have been identified, fill those in with the provider name, the date the appointment is arranged, and what services you have in mind. The next question is also an asterisk. How many days until the anticipated discharge or transition to alternative services? And the last three questions there are also required. If the consumer will not need continuous services, have natural community supports been identified, and has the consumer been assisted in assessing them? Does the individual have a current crisis plan and understand how to assess the services and supports included in it? There is a section there to check the barriers to discharge. The narrative entry below will hold 2,000 characters, and you can describe the plan to overcome barriers to discharge. In this section, you can also include a clinical narrative and basically describing essentially the reason for requesting the service. For example, what behaviors, what symptoms does the consumer exhibit? What are the goals? What are the progress towards the identified goals? What benefit has the consumer demonstrated from this particular service you're requesting? We need a description of the discharge or a transition plan. If one of these items are not included, either attached as a document or included in this narrative, a clinician will call you to obtain that information via the telephone. The next page, again, is the determination status page, and again, it has the same four gray tabs at the bottom that allow you to either print the results page, print the entire auth request, download it, and also the button on the right that allows you to return to the home page. I'm going to turn it over to Callie to discuss the administrative denial process.
There are two types of denials that the provider can be given. The administrative denial, which is the most frequent one that is used, and that's because the consumer does not have Medicaid or it's not indicated that they have Medicaid eligibility in our Service Care Connect. And the other is the clinical denial. The administrative denial is if the consumer does not have Medicaid or it's not indicated. You will receive a call from the clinician that is processing your request for services, informing you that your request has been administratively denied due to not having Medicaid enrollment in our system. At that time, you will be instructed to resubmit the request with a Medicaid-eligible RAN. If the consumer is Medicaid eligible and it is not reflected in our system, you will be asked to submit verification documents to show verification of Medicaid eligibility. Our clinical department will forward this information to our eligibility department to be researched. If determined to be eligible, the records will be updated in our system, allowing the auth to be completed. And just as a note, if the particular RIN is not Medicaid eligible, you will receive a letter indicating that and a call before that letter comes out. If there's a clinical denial, which is rarely used or rarely happens, request for reconsideration and appeal. Prior to denial, the collaborative staff will support consumers and providers by offering alternative services that can meet the consumer's needs in the least restrictive setting. Appeals can be requested by a provider on behalf of a consumer by calling the collaborative at 866-359-7953. The appeal request must be received within 30 days of receipt of the denial. Two levels of appeals: internal physician advisor, or PA. This appeal is not the same PA who issued the denial. And it's not a subordinate of the original PA who issued the denial. And that PA must be licensed to practice in Illinois. And the external review by an independent reviewer that has license to practice in Illinois. The third level of appeal is to DMH per established procedures. DMH director's review. If the provider, consumer, or designated representative disagrees with the outcome of the recommendation, reconsideration request, an appeal may be filed within 5 days of receipt of the outcome of the reconsideration request. This review shall not be a clinical review, but rather a review to ensure that all applicable appeal procedures have been correctly applied and followed. The final administrative decision shall be subject to the judicial review exclusively as provided in the Administrative Review Law 735 ILCS 5/Article 3. That concludes our portion of the training, and now we'll turn it over to Chris to address technical issues. Chris?
I'm going to turn the call over to Leanne right now. Are you ready, Leanne?
Yes, I am.
Okay, thanks. Do you need me to show your screen?
Yes, please. Okay, I'm going to be talking to you about the eligibility for services for community services. There is both financial and clinical eligibility that's required in order for DMH to pay for mental health care for individuals. And you can find very detailed criteria within our provider manual. For both financial and clinical eligibility, I'm going to hit the highlights for you today. And again, the slides will be available to you, so you can review those and, of course, the full provider manual. The way that we know here in DMH which eligibility group an individual falls into is from the information that you provide to us when you do your registration. So information that was reviewed earlier today, that's how we establish eligibility. For financial eligibility, we're looking at an individual's household income and size. That determines what rate we are able to pay for individuals who don't have Medicaid. For individuals who are either not meeting criteria clinically for one of the eligibility groups, or if they have an income that's over 400% greater than the federal poverty guidelines, they will not be eligible for any payment from DHS CMH for their mental health services. Our first eligibility group, Eligibility Group 1, these are individuals that have Medicaid coverage. And so in order to be reimbursed for mental health services, the individual must be in need of mental health services for a mental health diagnosis or a suspected mental health diagnosis. There is a list of covered diagnoses, Rule 132 diagnoses, for the Division of Mental Health that is listed in your provider manual. It is pages and pages long. It's pretty comprehensive, but you should refer to that for any clarification on whether or not a specific diagnosis is included. Also, in order to be reimbursed by the Division of Mental Health for services, the individual can't be enrolled in the integrated care program, you know, any of the managed care stuff that's going on through HFS. If an individual is covered by one of those programs, then that program is responsible for reimbursing their mental health care, and you cannot bill the Division of Mental Health for their services. They must be enrolled and registered through DHS-DMH. Again, we went through that process earlier today. Chris went through all of those screens with you. That registration has to be on file before you can bill us for services. And they have to be currently eligible for Medicaid. For Eligibility Group 2, these are individuals who do not have Medicaid coverage but are in need of mental health services. We used to call this our target population group. We changed to these group numbers to try to make it a little less confusing because we used the word target and eligible in multiple different ways, and it was very confusing. So this is why we've gone to the numbers. We are looking at providing services for adults with serious mental illness and children with serious emotional disturbance. We define in pretty great detail exactly what is required in order to meet either of those criteria. First of all, the person must be in need of mental health services for their mental health diagnosis. Again, they have to be enrolled, registered with DMH. This includes a RIN, household income and size. They have to meet the diagnostic functioning level and treatment history criteria that I'm going to go through. We have separate criteria for adults and for children. For adults, in order to be considered to have a serious mental illness, they have to have emotional or behavioral functioning that is so impaired that it's interfering with their ability to remain in the community unless they have supportive treatment. The mental impairment has to be both severe and persistent, may result in limitation of capacity for primary daily living activities, interpersonal relationships, homemaking, self-care, employment or recreation, and may limit their ability to seek assistance that they may need for housing, medical or dental care, the other types of services or other types of financial assistance they might need in order to stay in the community. They must meet, first of all, the diagnostic list. This is a shorter diagnostic list than our full diagnostic list that I was referring to earlier for the Medicaid population. Specifically for this eligibility group, they have to meet one of the diagnoses that's listed on your screen right now. And in addition to having that diagnosis, they have to have either a treatment history. You'll see the different type of criteria that can meet the treatment history. They have to meet one of these. Continuous treatment of 6 months or more in inpatient, day treatment, or partial hospitalization, 6 months of continuous residence in a residential program, two or more admissions during a 12-month period, a history of using outpatient services over a one-year period continuously or intermittently that includes psychotropic medication management, case management, or outreach engagement services, or previous treatment in an outpatient modality and a history of at least one psychiatric hospitalization. They have to meet one of those. And then the functional criteria, there, section A of the functional criteria, there are seven things here. They can meet those, or they can meet section B. So you're looking at impairment in various areas of their life, or they may not have current impairment if they're qualifying under B, but they are receiving treatment, have a history of functional impairment within the past 5 years, and there's documentation that without continuing their treatment, there would be likely regression in their functional impairment. So this means, you know, if you've been treating someone and they're responding to that treatment, you don't have to just stop the treatment because their functional status is improving. For children and in DMH, we consider folks to be adults at age 18, so we're talking about birth through 17 years here. For serious emotional disturbance, we're talking about individuals that have been determined based on their assessment to have a serious emotional disturbance and to display serious cognitive, emotional, and behavioral dysfunctions. They have to have meet one of these diagnoses. It's a slightly different list, a slightly longer list for the children than for the adults. Then they have to have a treatment history. For children, we're looking at lifetime treatment. The treatment has to be for one of the DSM-4 diagnoses that was listed on the previous slide. We're looking at episodes of treatment or residential treatment, et cetera. Their functional criteria, for eligibility group 2, we've narrowed the functional criteria. This was done purposely because we are really trying to define the most serious emotional disturbances for this group. It's, of course, not intended to reflect the full range of possible impairments. The youth must meet 2 of the functional criteria, and the functional impairment has to be the result of mental health problems for which the child is or will be receiving care, and must be expected to persist if there is no treatment provided. The areas where we look for functional impairment in children include functioning in self-care, in the community, in social relationships, in their family, or at school. Eligibility group 3, this is what we call our non-Medicaid first presentation of psychosis criteria. You may remember that Chris mentioned in the registration that there were some first presentation of psychosis questions on there. This group was developed to try to apply some state funding for individuals who may be experiencing their first psychotic episode of mental health need. So they may not yet meet the full criteria for the eligibility group 2 because they might not yet have developed all the functional impairments, but we were trying to provide services for this group of individuals in an effort to intervene before they develop a further disability from their mental health condition. So the individual has to be in need of services for a mental health diagnosis. They have to be enrolled again with us and have a RIN. You have to provide their household income and size. They have to meet specific age and diagnostic and treatment history criteria. So they have to be between the ages of 18 up until age 41 at the first presentation for mental health services. Their diagnosis has to have been given by a psychiatrist and has to be a diagnosis that's on this list here on the slide. They must have had minimal or no prior mental health treatment, again, because we're looking for those first episode individuals, with no more than 16 weeks of any antipsychotic medications prescribed, and no history of autism, pervasive developmental disorder, mental retardation, or organic brain issues that require ongoing primary services for any of these problems. And finally, eligibility group 4. This is what we used to call in DMH our eligible population. This is an eligibility group for individuals who don't have Medicaid, who are in need of mental health services but may not have the same level of impairment as those individuals with serious mental illness that we identify for eligibility group 2. They have to be in need of services and be registered, and their diagnostic and functioning criteria, they have to have one of the diagnoses that's on the more extensive list of diagnosis codes in the provider manual. They have to have a significant impairment in an area of life functioning. They have to meet financial criteria of less than 400% of the federal poverty level. We have different service benefit packages based on which eligibility group the individual falls into. For group 1, which is, again, those Medicaid individuals, they are entitled to all medically necessary Rule 132 services, so we will reimburse any medically necessary 132 service for individuals with Medicaid. For group 2, these are individuals who don't have Medicaid but meet what we formerly refer to as our target population, as well as group 3, our non-Medicaid first presentation individuals. They are entitled to whatever crisis intervention service is necessary, and then limited amounts of mental health assessment, case management, and psychotropic medication. For group 4, the non-Medicaid eligible population, they are entitled to crisis intervention services. Not entitled. We will pay for crisis intervention services, as well as limited amounts of mental health assessment. Okay, that is the end of my presentation, Chris. So I'm going to turn the screen back over to you, and you can.
Okay, Mary.
Yes. I'm going to just talk briefly about the submission of claims, and then I think we still have Rich will talk about the provider database and provider access. So just a couple of things that I wanted to emphasize with regard to the submission of claims. So as we've already said, providers have to be enrolled with both HFS and the collaborative in order to submit claims. Consumers must have RINs, and they must have a Social Service Package B designation. If a consumer does not have a RIN, you know, and this is probably not brand new news for most of you, but if a consumer does not have a RIN, you have to request one. If the individual does not have Social Services Package B, you have to request it. You have to request Social Services Package B. Both of those are obtained from DHS through the eRIN system. And again, I figure that most of you probably bill Medicaid services in other venues, so you probably know about the RIN system. But if you don't, there's information on the DHS website about the eRIN system. In order to submit any claim for an individual, therefore, there has to be a relationship established between the provider and the consumer, meaning if there's no valid registration on file that's submitted by you, there's no processing of a claim. Occasionally, you may find that an individual has multiple RINs. The collaborative receives a daily eligibility file from HFS containing RINs. So, you know, again, occasionally an individual may have been signed two or more RINs. Whenever this occurs, you really have to work
with the collaborative to have those RINs merged into one correct RIN. In terms of submitting claims, I think this may have been covered yesterday, but I did just want to mention it again. You know, the service reimbursement guide, known as the Service Definition Reimbursement Guide, is posted on the DHS DMH website at www.dhs.state.il.us under the Provider Portal Mental Health Division Community-Based Services Rule. And that, of course, provides all of the service definitions. But also on the collaborative website, there's a service matrix posted. And, you know, again, the website address is www.illinoismentalhealthcollaborative.com. The service matrix provides a nice summary of billable services, reimbursement rates, and HCPCS codes. One of the things that I wanted to point out is that I'm sure you know this, but I'll point it out just in case you're not thinking about this. It is critically important to review HFS documentation regarding the submission of claims. The provider handbook is posted on the HFS website. Chapter 300, the 5010 companion guide, is where you want to go and review information. As you submit claims, you can submit individual claims using the HFS Medi system, or you can submit claims using a batch format, again, using the standard 5010 format, which is described in the companion guide. HFS issues remittance advice, paper 835s, once claims are processed and adjudicated. So a few months ago, you would have had to wait until warrants were actually issued by the comptroller's office in order to receive admittance advice. HFS has made changes to their process. If you're not aware of that, they actually send out 835s, again, once claims are processed and adjudicated. So you have some information that you can check pretty much on a weekly basis to determine if your claims have been successfully processed and adjudicated. Of course, you can also go to the Medi system to check individual claims, but then you're basically checking one claim at a time. You may be familiar with the SMART Act regulations that basically talk about 180-day timely filing submission for clean claims. So as a reminder, that just basically means that you have to submit a clean claim 180 days from the service date. It used to be a year. So what that means is when you submit your claims, you need to check ASAP to determine how they've processed, so that if there are any errors, you can make those corrections and then get your claims resubmitted so that you have a clean claim within the timely filing time period. Just a couple of tips, and again, you probably already know this. There are error codes posted on the the HFS website in the provider handbook under Chapter 100. You should be able to, you know, if you have some errors on claims that you've submitted, you should be able to review those error codes and to figure out how to make corrections so that you can submit a clean claim. If you can't figure it out, or if you have any questions at any point in time about the errors that you receive, the first place that you always want to start is with the HFS billing consultants, who are housed in the HFS Bureau of Comprehensive Health Services. Their phone number is 877-782-5565. Press 0 and then ask for a community mental health support consultant. That's, again, the first place that you always want to start. Just a couple of other tips, and then we'll move on to Rich.
when Trish gave her presentation earlier about submitting registrations, you know, I can't emphasize enough, always check the registration file results to determine if the registrations that you have submitted have been accepted before submitting claims. That will save you lots of work. If you submit claims and you don't have a valid registration on file, the only thing that's going to happen is that those claims are going to reject. One of the biggest mistakes that providers have made in the past is to wait for claims to adjudicate, you know, wait to get some remittance advice back from HFS before they check to determine if a registration was accepted. You know, you don't have to do that. As Trish said, there are files that are generated that give you the results of the registrations that you've submitted. So, you know, again, just have to emphasize, it's critically important to make sure that your registrations have been accepted. It'll save you a lot of work, and it will save us a lot of work. As a strategy, one thing that I might suggest is, you know, as you start to do your registrations and submit them, you might submit a very small batch of registrations just to make sure you're on the right track, and then check the results there. You know, if everything is successful, if everything clears, then you know, again, that you're on the right track. Same thing for submission of claims. I would recommend that you submit a small batch of claims, again, just to be sure that you are on the right track, you know, that your registrations are valid, that the claims are going through, and that the remittance that's being generated actually shows that you are being paid the amount, the rate that you should be paid. So those are hopefully some of my helpful tips. You know, we're always happy to answer questions about this, but, you know, we want to see you successfully submit both registrations and claims so that you will be paid for the services that you provide to individuals with mental illnesses whose services are purchased by DMH. Rich or Chris, whichever of you will go next.
Okay, thank you, Mary. Chris, are you able to see my screen now?
Yes, thanks.
Okay. For the people who are participating today, this first part of my presentation will be a quick review of the painful provider enrollment process we just completed. But I wanted to review it again because I know I've already had questions from the new providers. Well, I want to add some sites. What do I have to do? And in the course of conducting business, there'll be times you'll want to add and close locations, service locations. And so it's always nice to keep the process up front as a reminder for folks. First off, understand that there is a enrollment process that includes these points right here. Starting point is talking to your regional office to make sure you have regional DMH approval to kind of move to what you are trying to do and opening up a new location, as well as the Central Division of Mental Health Office approval. Any site that is brand new or any site at all that you are submitting claims from need to have a Medicaid certificate that is issued from the Bureau of Accreditation and Licensing and Certification, BALC, or by DCFS to provide Rule 132 services. Any site that you will be utilizing will also require a unique NPI number. We will also, you'll also have to provide the HMS enrollment forms and the documents they request, as well as the collaborative enrollment forms. And then finally, there's a process where we make sure all the information is synchronized between the systems so that the claims can be processed smoothly. It's important to kind of follow and recognize all those steps because Mary just talked about claim submission errors And sometimes the best way to head off all of that is make sure your location and everything is enrolled properly from the first place. So when you're at the point of needing to enroll with HFS, the HFS Provider Participation Unit requires numerous forms. One of them is the provider enrollment application, their agreement for participation, and their enrollment disclosure statement. And they require additional documentation such as your IRS W-9 form, the NPI letter that's issued for that site, and a copy of your certificate. Just kind of as a reminder, that's kind of my role too. So when you are at that point of you need to enroll with HFS, you can always reach out to me and I'll send you the information and the links and be a technical resource as needed for you with any questions that you might have as a provider. Once HFS submits the forms, and it's enrolled with HFS, HFS will issue a provider key, a Medicaid site ID number, and a provider information sheet. It's very important to review that, and if there are any corrections that need to be done, mark your corrections on that sheet and send it back to HFS PPU. Their guides, their manuals that Mary referenced earlier outlines the process, but again, we want to make sure that you have your payee address enrolled properly. We have the Medicaid payee ID enrolled and all the other NPI information accurate so you can successfully process your claims. Then at that point, once HFS has issued the Medicaid ID number, we need to enroll the site with the collaborative, and there's various forms that are necessary for that. You can find them at the collaborative form link. You can find them on, there's a tab on the collaborative homepage, but I have a link right here that goes straight to the forms. The most frequently used form is the Form 2, where you're changing your site location. This form is to be used for not only changing the services that could be provided at that site, but also some information about who the contact person is for that site or the phone number of that nature. There's also an administrative change form if you are changing your administrative information. We need to have accurate information in our database. It's very important. If you have a change in administrative structure, if your agency has been bought out by another company, if you have a new executive officer, if you are merging with another agency, all of these kinds of administrative structural changes need to be reported, and we use this form to capture that information. And then finally, there's an NPI submission form that is required as well. Maintaining this information, it's your responsibility as a provider to maintain this and maintain accurate and report accurate information to DMH and the collaborative. We require changes to this database through using these forms. Please don't just type me an email, say we're moving, and expect that things will get processed properly. You know, we have a system to make sure there's some checks and balances and everything is in order. And also there's the review process that DMH has, starting from the regional level, coming all the way up to the central office and as well. Another important part of the provider database is to reflect the change, and it's just a short reminder of how we do the reviews. We start we ask the forms to be sent to the regional contract manager, and I think yesterday Dan talked about the regional offices. We'd like you to reach out to the regional offices, and I'm sure they will be reaching out to you as well to make sure you're aware of who your contract manager is or who your point of contact is for any questions and things going on that you need to relate with the region. And we have a process where the contract manager looks at things to make sure everything is filled out appropriately and the services are matching up with what your certificate says you are certified to provide. And then the contract manager sends it to my attention, and then that it would get authorized for the database. We also annually do a provider database verification process, which is called the PDV, and that is just a mechanism to have the provider look at information, including the administrative and the service site detail, to make sure everything is accurate. And just for any questions along the way, I have my contact information listed on here as well. So, Chris, that ends my portion. If you would like to turn it over to you.
Thank you, Rich. Operator, we are ready to begin the Q&A session.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star then one. Please unmute your phone and record your name clearly when prompted. To withdraw your request, press star then two. Once again, if you do have a question, please press star then one. One moment, please, while we wait for the first question. Press star then one if you do have a question. We're still waiting for the first question. Our first question comes from Ann Peterson. Your line is open. You may ask your question.
Yes, since we're a new community provider for outpatient services, do we need a contract with DMH in order to get paid? Is on the Medi system, do you need a contract number? We were told we would probably get a contract with a $0 amount in it. We haven't gotten a contract yet. We keep being told we can go ahead and provide services, bill for services, but we don't have a contract yet. So is that a required element before we'll be paid for services?
This is Mary Smith. I will have to check with HFS and look at the requirements for billing. And we'll also discuss it here internally within DMH and get some information out to you.
Okay.
We'll get it out to the whole group.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Please press star then one if you do have a question.
This is Leanne Reinert from DMH. I just wanted to respond to the question. If you're talking about billing Medicaid, you do not have to have a contract with DMH in order to bill Medicaid.
Our next question comes from Vicki Tello. Your line is open.
Hi. I was just wondering, in regards to the registration process that you guys were showing at the beginning, if we're a new community mental health center that's starting this process, I know that the registration was showing putting new consumers in if they either aren't in the search or they haven't been to any other providers beforehand. What is the process if they're brand new to your organization and you haven't seen them yet, but you need to put in diagnosis codes and all these other sorts of things in order to set them up to be reimbursed?
This is Mary Smith. You still, okay, so you, even if someone has seen them before, you know, they're basically new to your organization. And so the expectation is that you would make sure that they have a valid RIN, that they have Social Services Package B. You have to do all of the assessments that we talked about earlier. And again, you'll be receiving some training on how to complete the LOCUS and some of the children's assessment scales. But the expectation is that you would do an assessment using all of the instruments that we talk about, and then you would enter that information into the registration. And it's necessary to do that before you can submit a claim.
So as far as doing the preliminary assessments and all the LOCUS, you know, and all the other tests and things for kids versus adults, how does reimbursement work for us then as an organization before we can complete all that and have them registered to then be reimbursed through DMH or through Medicaid?
There is no reimbursement unless you register an individual. That is a DMH requirement.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Our next question comes from Eric Ward. Your line is open.
Hi, my question is related to non-Medicaid services. I'm wondering, are we able to bill for non-Medicaid services as a Medicaid provider, or are we required to have a separate contract and or capacity grant to do that?
The non-Medicaid services require a separate capacity grant contract for that non-Medicaid service. So if you don't currently have one of those contracts, you can't bill for the non-Medicaid services, only the Medicaid ones.
And who do we speak to about getting a capacity grant or applying for that?
You would start with your regional office.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Please press star then one if you do have a question. One moment while we pause to see if there are further questions. Star one to ask your question. Ann Peterson, your line is open.
Yes. On the registration, we have to enter the household income and the size of the household. Is there any verification we needed to do for that household income? We were told by someone else that you had to get proof of income, paycheck stubs, tax returns, et cetera. Are we required to do any of that or just get a figure from the consumer or the guardian? Thank you.
It's Mary. DMH does expect you to look at some documentation around income. If you can't get that, you know, then there is that qualifying exception that basically says that you're unable to review any documentation.
Okay.
Thank you.
Press star one to ask your question. We'll pause to see if there are any further questions at this time. I show no responses.
Chris, if there are no questions, I think we can wrap it up.
We do have a late question. It comes from Ann Peterson. Shall we take that?
Sure.
Peterson, your line is open. Ann Peterson, your line is open. Please check your mute button.
I'm just curious, on one of the forms that indicated a Williams-class consumer, what is a Williams-class consumer?
The Williams-class consumers are individuals who are entitled to a certain set of services because they are part of a consent decree class. The Williams consent decree covers individuals who reside in one of 24 IMDs within the state. Most of them are in Cook and suburban Cook County. There's one in Peoria and one in Decatur as well. And so the individuals are currently residing in an IMD, and the division and the state is under a consent decree agreement to provide whatever services are necessary to help them move out of the IMDs.
Okay, thank you.
There are no further questions. I'll now turn the call back to your speakers.
Rich, would you like to give some closing remarks?
Yes, I would just like to thank everyone for their participation today, and we appreciate your time and patience in taking the time and dedicating it to this process that we have gone through. Again, if you have other questions that happen to arise, you can direct them to my attention. You have my email address, and I will forward them on to the correct department or division or the person of expertise. And if you would keep tuned, we will have all of these information and the handouts and everything posted, as has been explained before, on the collaborative website. So I just want to thank you for your participation, and I wish you well.
This does conclude today's conference. Thank you for joining us. You may disconnect at this time.